Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to your Monday afternoon. The hard part of Monday's over. Now we're cruising into the easier part of Monday, which is, well, your Monday workday almost being over. We got a good show today. We're going to be talking a lot about Brett Kavanaugh, as you might imagine. And mostly because and my producer today is Eric in our rotating cast of producers. Marlon's off today or something. I don't know. They don't tell me anything. I just show up. I get who I get. That's what happens around here.
Yeah, you're kind of second class.
Second class. Whatever happened to Keith? I was gonna start complaining about keeping the talent happy, but I just can't bring myself to refer to myself as the talent. I don't got that much of an ego. I know what my job is around here. Just grind out quality talk radio. All right.
We're still working on that part. All right.
I'm right? So oh my God. Thanks, Eric.
No, it's good to be here. Marlon was on a couple days last week. I don't know. I believe he's probably going to be coming back full time, but
cool.
I'm not sure. I don't know either.
Yeah, nobody tells us anything. All right. So we're going to do good stuff. We're going to do fun stuff today. We're going to talk a little bit about the Kavanaugh thing. And I'll tell you, Eric, I have gotten phone calls from reporters from three national news outlets just calling. I mean, they're obviously covering North Dakota Senate race. The Supreme Court nomination of Brett Kavanaugh is a hugely important factor in that Senate race. In fact, I think people underestimate how important it is. Donald Trump, I would argue, is in the White House today because a lot of Republicans who might not otherwise be inclined to vote for him put him there because they didn't want Hillary Clinton making Supreme Court appointments. They didn't want Hillary Clinton making Supreme Court appointments. Like it or not, Supreme Court was never supposed to play this role in our republic, but it does. It is hugely politically important when it comes in terms of just settling public policy disputes. Republicans want Republican presidents to make those appointments. And so this is a hugely important issue. I've had national media reporters calling me all morning, you know, wanting my take on, you know, how I feel it's going to impact things here locally. So we'll talk about that coming up here in a little bit. We're also going to be talking at 1 o'clock. This was fascinating. Sidney Mook, Grand Forks Herald reporter, had a really fascinating article about the 25th Amendment. The 25th Amendment, of course, gets talked about a lot these days because it is the one that deals with presidential succession. The order of succession was put in place in 1967. It was prompted by the assassination of JFK. And it can also be used to remove. There is a portion of it that can be used to remove a president from office. North Dakota is one of just three states that never ratified the 25th Amendment. Kind of interesting. I didn't know about this. It gets talked about a lot today. I thought I'd bring on Sidney to talk about some of the unique history with the 25th Amendment as it deals with from North Dakota's perspective. So we could talk about that. Did you know that North Dakota also never ratified the 21st Amendment? Do you know what the 21st is? It's one of my favorite amendments. You know what the 21st Amendment is, Eric?
Is that repealing prohibition?
Repealing prohibition. You can always remember the two because the 18th Amendment implemented prohibition. The 21st Amendment repealed it. And you just think about it. From the 18, you become an adult. 21, you can drink. That's how I always remember it.
Sure.
21st Amendment, you got to be 21 years old to drink. Yeah, 20. North Dakota never ratified the 21st Amendment. We actually entered the Union. North Dakota entered the Union as a dry state. A lot of people don't know that.
What does not ratifying it have? Does it have any impact?
Doesn't do anything. Well, all the Constitution requires, obviously, to amend the Constitution, you've got to have not just a supermajority in both houses of Congress. You also have to have 3/4 of the states ratify it. So once they cross that threshold where 3/4 of the states ratify it, then it becomes an amendment to the Constitution. And it doesn't matter whether or not North Dakota ratifies it or not. Once it crosses that threshold, our vote essentially we voted present, I guess.
Sure.
It's the equivalent of like either, you know, abstaining, I suppose. It still passes. It still becomes law, right? Obviously, the 25th Amendment's law today. Obviously, the 21st Amendment is law today, even though North Dakota never ratified it. But yeah, that's it. I'll tell you, the state of Mississippi didn't ratify the 13th Amendment, emancipating the slaves, until like the 90s. But the 13th Amendment was still obviously part of the Constitution all that time, but sure. It took them over 100 years to do it. The funny thing is that they didn't, nobody alerted the federal government. Like when Mississippi, I think it was in the, it was 1995, they finally ratified the 13th Amendment. But nobody told the federal government about it, so it didn't officially get recorded until 2012.
Wow.
How do you like that? Anyway, just full of fun facts and fun history facts today here on the Rob Report. Yeah, fascinating stuff, though. And there's some amendments, because a lot of times there's not a time limit. Like, a lot of times what will happen is Congress will pass a proposed constitutional amendment. I don't say a lot of times. It doesn't happen a lot. But it has happened, and I'm forgetting which one it was. But where it could take decades for the states to ratify. And if Congress doesn't put like a time limit on in the legislation, it can just sit there. And the amendment, once Congress passes it, unless Congress repeals that, it could just sit around. And maybe decades later, finally, we reached a point where 3/4 of the states have ratified it. Now, all of a sudden, it becomes an amendment. Like, it can happen that way, too. It's really kind of a weird process, and it doesn't get used a lot. But anyway, we're going to talk with Sidney Mook about the 25th Amendment, because it gets talked about a lot today, because a lot of people don't want President Trump to be in office anymore. Also, and I thought this was an interesting idea, Eric, what would you think about passenger rail service from Fargo to Chicago?
I don't know how much it would be used, but it certainly is intriguing. I've never taken a train. I've always wanted to.
We used to take it a lot, because when I lived in Alaska, what we would do is we would take, Alaska has a ferry. We have like a public ferry where you drive your car on, and then you can ride the ferry down to Seattle. And then we'd catch the train over to North Dakota. Super cheap way to get down from lower 48 from Alaska. So we used to ride the Empire Builder all the time over from Washington to here. And so I think a lot of people use it. I like the idea generally. I do worry about how much Amtrak costs, though. In terms of rider miles. And I did the math years ago, and I mean, it's heavily subsidized, particularly the long distance routes. Where Amtrak really works is like the Northeastern corridor, where you get a lot of people commuting all the time.
Right.
Amtrak's actually profitable out there. Where Amtrak's not profitable is out here in the western parts, where you have like the Empire Builder loses a lot of money, because it's got all those empty miles. It's going through relatively small communities. And not a lot of people use it to travel. But anyway, there's a group called All Aboard Minnesota. We're going to talk with Brian Nelson from that group. They're proposing passenger service coming from Chicago through cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, St. Cloud, and then ultimately coming into Fargo. And I think that might be interesting. That's sort of a shorter route if there's the passenger demand for it. Could be successful. Anyway, it's interesting idea. We'll talk with him coming up at 1:30. Plus your phone call, 701-293-9000, 888-970-9329. Email talk at WDAY.com. All right, let's talk about Brett Kavanaugh. We saw last week where a letter came out. At the time, it was an anonymous letter, a lot of vague details. Over the weekend, we got the person who making the accusations on the record. You know, she's out there. She's in the Washington Post now. She's got an attorney who is representing her. They're speaking publicly about this. And this is a real issue. Her name's Christine Blasley Ford. I'm sure at this point, I'm not telling you unless you've been living under a rock. We know all about this. You know all about this. The question now is whether or not Kavanaugh could still get confirmed. What do we do with this now? Right. And what's frustrating about this whole thing is the way Democrats sat on this. I mean, this whole thing is harder. It's already hard, as we've seen with the Me Too movement. We saw with the Cosby trial. It's already next to impossible sometimes to adjudicate these sort of whether we're talking about in a court of law or even in the court of public opinion. It becomes next to impossible to try to reach some level of justice in this process when we're talking about accusations that are decades old. When it starts to happen in an intensely partisan and intensely political environment, it becomes even harder. And so Democrats, I think, did us all a disservice in the way that they dropped this on us. I understand why they did it politically. and all the people who have been calling me today asking about, you know, what this means for the Senate race, I could tell you, Democrats were absolutely thinking about people like Heidi Heitkamp when they sat on this letter and they didn't release it right away. Because what serves Heidi Heitkamp the best is maybe not having to vote on Brett Kavanaugh in an election year. If they could push the vote back far enough and get it out past the election, maybe the Republicans vote on it during their lame duck session, I don't know. But if they can, at the very least, even if they don't end up ultimately doing in Kavanaugh's nomination, at the very least, if they could just make it so that somebody like Heidi Heitkamp, or maybe a tester in Montana or what have you, doesn't have to vote on it this election cycle, these red state Democrats who are campaigning for their lives, then that's to the good. And I think that's absolutely fed into the timing of this. But then on the other hand, if Brett Kavanaugh really did this, 35 or however many decades ago, or going on 4 decades ago, if he really did this, then he shouldn't be on the Supreme Court. Not just because he did it when he was 17, but because now he's lying to all of us on the record saying he didn't do it. So if it turns out that he really did do it, well, then he shouldn't sit on the Supreme Court. I think we should put that up first and foremost. But there are a lot of problems with her story right now. And the problem is we're all being asked, who do we believe? And I keep hearing everybody say, well, this is the court of opinion. This isn't a court of law. Therefore, there's a lower standard. And I guess, yeah, that's true. But the problem is, should what we believe about Judge Kavanaugh hinge on whether we're a Republican or a Democrat? Should it hinge on whether or not we like him for the Supreme Court? If you like his judicial philosophy, I mean, should it be our belief or not belief, as the case may be, of these accusations? Should it hinge on politics? Because I don't think so. And there are some real problems with this story, and we're going to get into them in the next segment. But before we go to a break, I want to sneak John on the air here. John, go ahead. What's up?
Yeah, this is really confusing. It's like at the last minute, all this stuff comes out, even just like Trump on some stuff. And now it's how long ago? I mean, we're looking almost, 20, 30 years that this so-called incident happened?
I think it's like 35, yeah.
Yeah, and now you're looking at jurisdiction. Okay, so where's the jurisdiction in call? I mean, the statute of limitations has gone way far beyond it.
Well, there's a reason.
Unless they got jurisdiction for the last 30 years, well, I guess she better file for a criminal complaint then.
Well, I don't know the status. I'm not familiar enough with the laws of the state of Maryland to tell you anything about the statute of limitations. I could tell you, though, that as a concept, the reason why the statute of limitations exists is so that we're not trying to remove even the possibility with some types of crime of trying to go back 20, 30 years after the fact and reach a conclusion that has anything to do with justice. The statute of limitations
exactly.
As a concept is a recognition of how difficult it is to establish the truth after a certain amount of time has gone by. And there
exactly.
are some problems with her story that are related exactly to that I'm going to get into after the break. John, what do you think the Senate ought to do with this?
I personally, it's the same old story. We always hear about everything investigate. You have to. You got no choice in the matter. And then find out what's going on. But, you know, it's the fact of her story is just too many holes in it, I guess. You know, if I was a senator, and I'd be looking, and I'd be questioning her side on this because it doesn't add up. I don't understand why she didn't do this 15, 20 years ago when he was still in the political arena.
Here's the thing.
Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, here's the problem I have. Thanks for the call, John. Appreciate it. Here's the problem I have with the people saying that, well, this is the court of public opinion, not a court of law. Okay, fine. I get that. I understand that a Senate confirmation to the United States Supreme Court is not a process that necessarily requires the beyond the reasonable doubt standard. Here's the thing, though. One thing that I do think that we should preserve from the criminal side, like if this was in a criminal court of law, I still think the burden of proof is on the accuser, right? I still think that's got to be the formulation. She's the one making this accusation. The people who believe that it's true, it's up to them to provide the truth, right? It's up to them to provide the facts and to fill in the gaps and to convince the rest of us. Because in the absence of more information than what we have before us now, I'm inclined to believe I'm inclined, frankly, to believe Judge Kavanaugh at this point. Now, that being said, and this is what I think ought to happen, and I'd love to hear what you think the Senate ought to do with this. 701-293-9000, 888-970-9329, email talk at WDAY.com. What I think ought to happen is I do think they ought to delay the Senate judiciary vote on this for a bit, allow both the accuser and Judge Kavanaugh to testify before the committee on the record, allow some time to see if we get any other information, any other, you know, physical evidence, a journal, another witness. I don't know what could be out there, but just allow some time for other information to come forward. And then if no other, if we're left after all of that, where we are today, then I say you confirm Judge Kavanaugh. That's where I'm at now. Barring new information, I don't think that this is enough. What do you think? 701-293-9000, 888-970-9329, email talk at WDAY.com. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. Rob Report, 970 WDAY AM 93.1 FM. Question, what do you think you ought to happen with the Kavanaugh situation? And like I said in the last segment, I think we got to give the accusations a degree of seriousness, right? I mean, it's a serious accusation. I know there's a lot of people out there pointing out that this woman is a partisan Democrat. She's engaged as a protest. I mean, she's a liberal. And unfortunately, she made the decision when she decided to make this public to work through Democratic politicians who in turn clearly delayed announcements and stuff so that for political reasons. That's all unfortunate. But all that being said, it's still a serious accusation. I don't think there's anything wrong with delaying the Senate Judiciary Committee vote to allow for Judge Kavanaugh to respond to this under oath, and B, for the accuser also to talk about her situation under oath, but then also allow some room if there's more evidence out there to come out. Because I tell you, somebody who treats women like this, it usually doesn't happen in a vacuum, right, Eric? I mean, I think that's something when you look at Harvey Weinstein, you look at a lot of the things we've seen, Bill Cosby. If you're inclined to commit this sort of a crime, It doesn't happen once.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I see what you're saying.
So let's create some room. Let's see what else is out there. That said, though, I mean, once an appropriate amount of time's gone by, and I don't know, a few weeks, then I say you hold the votes and you move forward. If nothing else new comes forward, then I think you got to move forward.
Yep.
Caller, Jeff, you're on. What's up?
Hey, Rob. Just a couple quick comments, and I'll hang up and listen.
Sure.
My biggest thing, if he did indeed do it, I don't want him on the Supreme Court.
I agree.
I mean, he's an animal. But my problem, the other point I have to make is, I guess I'm wondering the amount of time that went by and they sat on it like they did. And my other comment is, from what I've read, there was two guys in the room with her. What is the other guy saying?
Yeah, well, the other guy denies it as well. The other guy denies it as well. Yeah, the other guy, okay. His last name, I'm forgetting his name now.
I mean, of course he would, even if it happened. Yeah. But, you know, now we're down to she says and then they say, you know, yeah. So I don't know. If they'd have come right out with it, I'd have a better feeling about it. But it's like it was a last ditch attempt to make sure they win, you know.
Well, here's some other.
Hey, you have a great day.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Here's some other things about the accusation. For one, she says that she told a therapist about this in 2012. Didn't mention Kavanaugh's name, but did say that she had an incident with somebody who went on to become very prominent in Washington, D.C. Obviously, you know, you could say that's Kavanaugh, but she didn't use his name. That was in 2012. The thing, though, her therapist took notes. The problem is the therapist's notes at the time Christine Blasley Ford said that there were four boys involved. Now she's saying two and that the therapist made mistakes, but there's a problem. There's a discrepancy in her story. The other problem is, and I'm quoting now, this is from the Washington Post story, which is the first to report her going on the record. They report, I quote, after so many years, Ford says she does not remember some key details of the incident. She said she believes it occurred in the summer of 1982 when she was 15, around the end of her sophomore year at the all-girls Holton Arms School in Bethesda. Kavanaugh would have been 17 at the end of his junior year at Georgetown Prep. She doesn't know when it happened. She also doesn't remember the name of the people who were holding the house party or even where the house is. So she doesn't know when. She doesn't know where. And now we have her telling at two different times, two different stories about the number of people who were there. Now, That doesn't mean that she's lying. It just speaks to her credibility. Those are problems. Let's take a break. We'll come right back. Rob Report, 970 WDY AM 93.1 FM. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back. Rob Report, 970 WDY AM 93.1 FM. Talking about the accusations against Judge Kavanaugh. And really, I mean, this is an interesting exercise because during the Me Too, you know, the whole Me Too thing with the Harvey Weinstein and all the stuff where all of a sudden we just saw a tidal wave of people uncovering a lot of cruddy behavior by people in power, mostly men, not all, but mostly men. It was a cathartic moment, I think, for our nation and a positive shift in the right direction. We were going to start taking those sorts of accusations and those sorts of situations more seriously. I absolutely agree with that. What has always caused me to want to pull back on the reins, though, a little bit, is concern that we're going to sweep too many people up, or we're going to empower accusers so much to where simply making an accusation can ruin somebody's life. And I think that's what we've got to think about with Judge Kavanaugh. Now, this situation should be investigated, and we should allow some time in the process to see if other evidence comes forward. The Senate Judiciary Committee should hear again from Judge Kavanaugh under oath responding to this. And we should hear from the accuser. In fact, the accuser should go first under oath. And it seems like both are willing to do that. So I hope that's a thing that happens. But the thing is in for want of more information, this isn't enough. And also, I don't think Democrats, again, barring some new revelation, I don't think Democrats should get to it by playing games with this. And this is the unfortunate thing that Kavanaugh's accuser did, is she decided that when she was going to go public with this, she was going to go to a Democratic politician, right? When she first wrote her letter, she wrote it to her Democratic congresswoman, and that congresswoman then passed it on to Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is the ranking member, Democratic member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And Senator Feinstein sat on it and chose not to release it until well into the process. Senator Feinstein chose not to release it until after Judge Kavanaugh had already testified for 3 days before the Senate Judiciary Committee under oath. Why not ask him about it then? She chose not to release it until after she met with with Judge Kavanaugh personally. Didn't release it then. Didn't forward it to the authorities until then. I mean, how can the Democrats say that they take this accusation seriously when they didn't surface it immediately, which is a point that an emailer makes? Kenneth writes, Dianne Feinstein and possibly more Dems, but he thinks Schumer for sure, had this information and chose not to ask Kavanaugh about it. She waited, and gave it to the FBI. I think the goal was not necessarily to torpedo the nomination, but to delay it. We can't have a vote on a nominee until the FBI concludes a thorough investigation. Play for time. Trump Republicans won't abandon Kavanaugh, and everything grinds to a halt until after the November elections. Additionally, the red state Democrats don't have to commit to a tough vote. Red state Democrats, like I would add, Senator Heidi Heitkamp. If the Dems regain power, they go into full Miguel Estrada 2.0 revenge mode until after the 2020 presidential elections or as long as they control the Senate. 4-4 ties in the Supreme Court cases are okay with them, much better than losing 5-4. The flounder best laid plan was the FBI saying, meh. The FBI, by the way, choosing not to investigate the matter. I don't know that the FBI said, meh. I think the FBI was just recognizing this is outside of their jurisdiction. If there's going to be a criminal proceeding in this, it should proceed out of the state of Maryland. And I don't know. To this point, have you heard anything, Eric? Have we heard anything about, I don't know that we have, about authorities in Maryland investigating or reviewing this matter at all?
No, I haven't heard of anything either. Yeah, but the whole thing is political and suspect.
It is. I mean, if it wasn't, then the minute you get this letter, you make it public, right? The minute you get this letter, we say, listen, we have serious accusations against Judge Kavanaugh. We forwarded them to the appropriate authorities for investigation, right? That's how you handle it.
Yep.
If you take it seriously. Now, if you're playing for time, right? If you're motivated by politics and you want to keep it so that somebody like Senator Heidi Heitkamp doesn't have to vote. And I'll tell you, I mean, I've had, again, multiple national media outlets contacting me this morning asking me how I feel this is going to impact North Dakota Senate election. And I can tell you, this is great for Heidi Heitkamp. Just objectively, this is good news for her. Prior to this situation, that vote on Kavanaugh was a no-win situation for her, right? Because her Democratic, her liberal base has raised the stakes on Kavanaugh so high, right? I mean, you had Senator Gillibrand from New York literally saying that women are going to die if Kavanaugh is put on the Supreme Court, right? So they are literally making this a life or death situation. That's where our friends on the left have put the stakes for this confirmation. So if Senator Heitkamp votes for Kavanaugh, now all of a sudden she's going to lose people out of her liberal base. The problem, though, is she votes against him. Senator Heitkamp has invested a lot of time and a lot of energy into making herself appeal across the aisle in North Dakota. That's why she's out there campaigning, that she's an independent voice, right? She's sort of eschewing affiliation with her national political party. Talking about what a moderate it is, bragging about how often she votes with President Trump. As a matter of fact, even having her surrogates go out there and act as though she's a better liked by President Trump than Kevin Cramer is. And so if she votes against Kavanaugh, now she risks hiring the sort of red state Trump voter she needs to win over in order to win in November. So prior to all of this, this was a no-win situation for Heidi Heitkamp. She had nowhere to go. But now, all of a sudden, she's got some cover. Now, all of a sudden, the waters are muddied a little bit. Right? Now, all of a sudden, she could cast a vote against him and say it was motivated by this accusation. And whether, you know, I don't know how many people will believe her. I don't know. That'll depend, I think, on what we know about this situation closer to the vote. But she has some political cover now. She has a way to vote against this without it being about partisanship or ideology. She could say, oh, no, and she could now choose a third way and say, no, it was about these accusations left me deeply concerned. I don't think he's fit to sit on the Supreme Court. Whether you or I disagree with it, that's a different thing than her voting in lockstep with Chuck Schumer. That's a different narrative that she could tell on the campaign trail. I'm not saying it'll be enough. I'm not saying that the Kavanaugh vote won't still be a problem for her, but it's less of a problem, and that's those set of circumstances than it would have been. 701-293-9000-888-970-9329. Email talk at WDY.com. Emailer says, Rob, if we want the truth, we should waterboard the nominee.
Okay.
No, I don't know. let's see. Mona says, Rob, really, a 30-year-old accusation. Where was she 10, 20, even 30 years ago? Funny, we elected a senator who left a young lady to drown in a lake. We elected a president who was accused of rape. What a joke. It is interesting. I mean, obviously, the emailer referring to Ted Kennedy, Bill Clinton. Here's the thing. We have a contemporary example right now in Minnesota, just across the Red River. We have a sitting congressman who is accused on the record by a woman of engaging in physical violence against her. He's a sitting congressman, Keith Ellison, currently running for attorney general. Democrats are standing beside him. Despite a woman saying on the record, a woman and her son saying on the record that he physically abused her. Now, I don't know that. I think that woman's accusation has some problems as well. She's spoken about a video that has yet to be made part of the public record. I think that's extremely problematic. So I don't know that the accusations against Keith Ellison should be disqualifying. I've said that since the beginning. I also don't think that the accusations against Kavanaugh, what we know of them right now, should be disqualifying. And by the way, the accusations of both instances were timed, right? The accusations against Ellison were timed and released right before the state primary election, which was a contested primary. Ellison was facing competition from other Democrats. The Kavanaugh information was timed to be right before the Senate Judiciary vote on his confirmation. So in both instances, highly political problems, but you got to put this in context. Democrats don't get to say, well, Kavanaugh's disqualified unless you're willing to make the same argument about Keith Ellison. 701-293-9000-888-970-9329. Email talk at WDAY.com. Lyle emails, Feinstein did not release because victim did not want her name disclosed. Feinstein eventually released because the media was about to do so. Republicans called for immediate resignation of Senator Franken upon mere allegations, but now, but for a few senators, dismissed the charge. Hypocrisy again rules the day. I would note that it wasn't just Republicans who called for the resignation of Senator Franken. It was Democrats, too, up to including Senator Heidi Heitkamp. A lot of those Democrats have backtracked now. Also, Feinstein didn't have to release the victim's name. Feinstein still, if she considered the accusations to be serious enough, could have still forwarded the information on to the appropriate law enforcement sources. That's not the same as making that person's identity known to the public. So your excuses run a little thin, Lyle. Let's take a break. We'll come right back. Rob Report 970 WDAY AM 93.1 FM. Don't go away. Welcome back. Rob Report 970 WDAY AM 93.1 FM. By the way, I was talking about the Senate race. Both Congressman Cramer and Senator Heitkamp have released statements. This is Senator Heitkamp, so I'm reading from Twitter. This is a very serious allegation which should be thoroughly investigated, and it's up to the Senate Judiciary Committee to do just that. Professor Ford should be given an opportunity to testify before the committee, and she is willing to do so. Judge Kavanaugh has also expressed his willingness to discuss the issue with the committee. It takes courage for any woman to speak up about sexual assault, and we need to respect Professor Ford by listening to her and hearing her story. I'll be honest with you. I think that side's a little bit too far on the side of just automatically believing. I mean, at what point do we not allow somebody to just make an accusation and then completely derail a man's life? I realize, again, we're not in a court of law. But on the other hand, we're talking about a real human being here who's being accused of something hugely serious. And we're talking about two human beings here who are saying completely contradictory things about something awful that was alleged by one of them to have happened 35 years ago. Now, I'm in favor of allowing some more time for more evidence to come out. I'm in favor of both of them testifying under oath before the Senate Judiciary Committee. But absent some additional information, I don't think we could find Professor Ford's accusations to be well enough to derail Kavanaugh's confirmation. I don't think she's met her burden of proof. I don't think we're there yet. I don't even think we're near there yet. And she has some contradictions in her story. By the way, this is Cramer's statement. He said, again, from Twitter, it is hard not to be skeptical considering the timing and history of the allegations. Of course, any allegation of this nature should be taken seriously, but absent significant evidence being brought forth immediately, I feel Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation process should proceed. Yeah, I think that's right. By the way, talking about Senator Heitkamp's statement, where is the criticism for her political party sitting on this accusation? Right? I mean, if she's talking about how it takes courage to speak up about sexual assault, well, does that include sitting on it and timing it for maximum political impact? If Senator Heitkamp means what she says about being this independent, about working across the aisle, about being against all the nonsense in Washington, D.C., where is her criticism for her own party for the way they handled this and made it harder for all of us to figure out what the truth is here? Caller, Karen, you're on. What's up?
Yes, when there is only one accuser against a national government person, then yes, we need to carefully examine this for whatever amount of time it takes to find out if this is true or untrue.
I agree with you. I do think there needs to be, I mean, there needs to be a limited amount of time, because part of the reason Democrats are trying to push this vote out past the election. That's what they're trying to do. They timed this for maximum political effect. I think we have enough time. We can allow a few weeks to see. I mean, there's reporters across the country who are furiously working on this. Certainly there's enough room right now for official investigations. Let's see what that turns up. I'm perfectly in favor of delaying this for a few weeks. I'm in favor of both Ford and Kavanaugh testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee under oath. I'm fine with all of that, but we ought to hold this vote before Election Day.
I don't know that this was delayed by Democrats necessarily. Why?
How can you say that? They had the letter, they had the accusation in July, Karen. What were they doing?
Well, it's up to the woman to come out publicly about a sexual assault.
Why did she wrote the letter to the congresswoman, the original congressman who got the letter, who forwarded it on to Senator Dianne Feinstein. She wrote the letter. At that point, why is it not forwarded on to the authorities?
It's up to the woman to do that.
She did. She wrote, what was her intent in writing Democrats in Congress about it?
This is going to be a hard thing for the lady to do if it is indeed true.
Yeah.
And it's her decision to do this.
And what made it harder is the fact that when she decided to tell her story, she went to Democrats in Congress who subsequently sat on it.
You don't force a woman to publicly...
Who's forcing her? Nobody forced her to write the letter. She wrote the letter, Karen.
That's a letter. It's different to come out publicly.
Oh. Listen, if she wants to be believed that she chose the absolute wrong way, she hurt her own credibility, and Democrats up to it, including Senator Feinstein, hurt her credibility by how the way they handled it. They just did. It looks like a political spectacle.
Well, that's why the woman is the one to decide if she wants to go through.
She did. She decided to write Democrats in Congress about it, Karen. That was her decision.
But I'm saying that's not up to Dianne Feinstein to put the woman into public.
No, but it was Senator Feinstein's choice to sit on the letter from July and only decide to forward it to the FBI and then issue a vague press release about it shortly before the Senate Judiciary Committee was going to take up the vote on Kavanaugh. Karen, I'm sorry. You're just wrong. Democrats handled this terribly. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. We're going to take a break. We'll come right back. Hey, we're going to talk a little bit about the 25th Amendment. Sydney Mook for the Grand Forks Herald had a great article about it over the weekend. This is the Rob Report, 970 WDYM, 93.1 FM. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. Hour 2, Rob Report, 970 WDYM, 93.1 FM. I'm still getting emails and everything in on the Kavanaugh thing. We'll get back to that a little bit more. But for now, we're going to take a break, and we're going to talk about something that... Well, I don't want to say it's fun, because we're talking about presidential succession, and if we're in a situation where the president needs to be succeeded by anyone not elected of the people, we're not in a great situation. It means, like, maybe somebody died or somebody got caught with their hands in the cookie jar. All of these things have happened. The reason why this matters is people have been talking about removing President Trump through the 25th Amendment. As a matter of fact, there was an anonymous contributor to the New York Times op-ed page, someone who says, and I guess the New York Times confirmed, knows who it is, somebody at the New York Times does anyway, that they're a member of President Trump's old cabinet, saying that the 25th, a section of the 25th Amendment ought to be invoked, which allows basically the cabinet to involuntarily remove the president. But what's interesting is that North Dakota holds kind of a unique place with the 25th Amendment in that our state never ratified it. Here to talk with me about it is Sydney Mook, who had a very interesting article about this over the weekend. It was interesting to me, Sydney, but I nerd out on this stuff big time.
I found it interesting to report on as well, kind of learning about it. You know, North Dakota is one of only three states that never ratified it. The other two are South Carolina and Georgia. So it's interesting to kind of look into everything.
And you actually looked at, I will say, the 25th Amendment, a lot of people don't realize this. It was actually, we didn't have presidential succession spelled out in this way until after JFK was assassinated. And what's interesting, Sydney, and maybe you know because you just looked into this, do you know shortly after the 25th Amendment was ratified, we actually, it led, its use led to the first president, the only president we've ever had, who was never elected to the executive branch at all. Do you know which president that was?
Yeah.
You have to look. It was Gerald Ford. Gerald R. Ford, who took over as vice president when Spiro Agnew resigned, and then took over as president when Richard Nixon resigned. Wasn't elected to either office, and then in 1974 became president of the United States. Kind of fun. Not fun. It was terrible. That was terrible, but fun, I guess, to think about and remember as a nerd. But why? You actually looked in. It wasn't that North Dakota just ignored the fact that the 25th Amendment had been passed by Congress. We actually took this up in the legislature, and there were some people who there was specifically one person who made an argument against it. What was their argument?
Yeah, so basically, you know, it came to the floor in 1967, and they brought it up, and it went through the Senate committee, all right, Senate, state and federal committee, all right. And then, you know, once it got to the House, it kind of hit a snag. There's a Representative Kenneth Knutson from Taylor, North Dakota, that kind of had some concerns with the amendment. Most of his concerns were, you know, he felt, first of all, that it was just a poor piece of legislation. And he thought that the fourth section, which is, you know, as you mentioned earlier, the process for, you know, the cabinet and then eventually a congressional decision to remove a president, he felt that that was a bad one. And, you know, he felt that, you know, he said it was a dangerous setup. And he didn't believe North Dakota had to give its consent. And at that time, when they were taking it up, about 20 states had already, you know, ratified the amendment. So the writing was kind of already on the wall that it was going to be ratified regardless. So they didn't necessarily have to do it.
Now, so essentially he was arguing that he was worried about, it was Section 4 specifically. And Section 4 is, because there's four sections of the 25th Amendment.
Yeah.
And it's for president. Section 1 is essentially if the president dies or if he resigns. So essentially the president, you know, either resigning the office or assassinated. The second is, it has to do with the vice presidential vacancy. Basically what happens is there's a vacancy in the vice president. Essentially the president nominates somebody new who's confirmed by Congress. Section 3 has to do with the president, you know, basically, saying that he's unable to discharge the powers of his office. So essentially the president saying, I'm too sick or I'm compromised or incapacitated in some way. Therefore, we need to transfer my powers to somebody else. But the fourth is the unwilling one, where it's essentially the cabinet can come together and say, okay, Mr. President, we can't allow you to exercise this power anymore. And that was the part that the North Dakota legislature had a problem with?
Yeah, that was the specific part. He basically, you know, this representative, you know, he said that, you know, he felt that it was a dangerous setup, you know, and maybe, you know, that's why the fourth section is the only section that has never been invoked. Sections 1 through 3 have been invoked at least once, but the fourth section is the only one that hasn't been invoked. And, you know, it's probably in part because it's likely the hardest one to invoke. You have to have the cabinet, and then you have to have Congress on board for that to happen. So it was kind of interesting looking into it. He asked for an indefinite postponement on discussion about it, and that's basically what he got. And it looks like it was never really taken up again after that.
Now, there have been two times in history prior, I guess, to the Trump administration where we have, again, this anonymous op-ed. But there were two situations during the Reagan administration in 1981 after the assassination attempt where, you know, President Reagan was obviously undergoing medical care. There was no opportunity to invoke Section 3. Vice President George H.W. Bush didn't assume presidential powers as acting president. So there was a feeling by some that Section 4 should have been invoked at that point to, at the very least in the interim, give the vice president at the time, George H.W. Bush, an opportunity. The other time was in 1987, Howard Baker, upon becoming White House Chief of Staff, was reportedly, and this was sort of famously, was told about the possible invocation of the 25th Amendment due to Reagan's perceived ineptitude and laziness at the time. And as a matter of fact, reportedly, Baker's staff, they wanted to use their first meeting with Reagan to evaluate whether or not he was losing his mental grip. So, I mean, this has been something where at least a couple of times in the past, it's been considered used, but never, as you said, actually used. And it is kind of a scary thing, because if you think about it, like you look at what's happens in other parts of the world where we have these coups or whatnot, where essentially a president gets deposed, you know, by the people around him or her, as the case may be, you know, it really opens the door where there's a legal channel for that in our executive branch. And I mean, it's a little scary because we're talking about it right now. And to think that our country, that we're used to being so stable, could get to a point where we have that much turmoil is a little scary. And I guess probably, you know, led to the North Dakota legislature saying, at least at the time, saying, well, you know, maybe this isn't a power we should have. So it's interesting. What prompted you to look into this in the first place? Was it that New York Times op-ed and the fact that this has been discussed so much, Sydney?
Yeah, it was basically, you know, the op-ed that had published, and then, you know, kind of while a lot of people were kind of like breaking down and looking at the 25th Amendment And, you know, it was mentioned somewhere that, you know, North Dakota, Georgia, and South Carolina were the only three states that never ratified the 25th Amendment. So we thought that was kind of interesting. So started looking into it and talked with, you know, folks from the UND Political Science Department, some legislative library council members, and we were able to kind of piece together a little bit, you know, of some of the history of why it ended, did not end up being ratified in North Dakota. And it was kind of a lot of fun to work on, actually.
Now, I saw that you mentioned a couple others, the 21st Amendment, which repealed the 18th Amendment, which was prohibition. North Dakota didn't ratify that one also. We also never ratified passed legislation regarding the 26th Amendment, which was essentially ensures that everybody over the age of 18 has the right to vote. So are those the only three then that North Dakota never ratified?
Yeah, other than the ones that would have came before them.
But prior to statehood.
Basically.
Right.
Those are the only three that we never ratified. And it was interesting with the 21st Amendment, we were the fourth state to ratify the 18th Amendment, which put in place prohibition.
Yeah.
And then we never ratified the 21st Amendment that would have repealed
that.
We
were kind of a pro-prohibition state. We entered the Union as a dry state. Yeah. So North Dakota very much at that time was not real keen on alcohol consumption, although that seems to have changed quite a bit since then. North Dakotans like their booze now. So this is just fascinating stuff, looking at this, looking at how we got to this point in the 25th Amendment. And Sydney, your report on it was extremely interesting. Certainly appreciated it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I had a very good time writing it.
I think it's fun to tie something that obviously is relevant to the moment, and we're talking about nationally, and sort of tie it back to our own state's history, because sometimes I don't know that we spend a lot of time considering that and the way these things become law. Sydney, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Sydney Mook, Grand Forks Herald reporter. I'm Rob Port. This is 970 WDAY AM, 93.1 FM. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back, Rob Report, 970 WDAY AM, 93.1 FM, 701-293-9000, 888-970-9329. Email talk at WDAY.com. Let's see. Senator Heitkamp putting out a statement about the Kavanaugh thing. I think Senator Heidi Heitkamp is going to be for whatever might keep her from having to vote on Kavanaugh. I think at this point, that's kind of where she's at. Whatever pushes this decision back the furthest is okay with her. I don't think it's going to be grounded in any real consideration. She's going to dress it up in other ways. But it's hard not to look at the Democrats and just see them handling the entire situation with Kavanaugh from just an explicitly political point of view. Emailer Dan says, get over yourself. Kavanaugh is the same as a priest abusing kids 40 to 50 years ago. People hold sex abuse issues their whole life without telling anyone. When the abused sees they are going to be in a high important office like the Supreme Court, they should come out. The timing of the assault isn't the issue. The abuse is. I agree with that to a point. Now, Dan, I think, is being hyper-partisan, because I can remember, you go back, you roll the tape back with people like Senator Feinstein, people like Senator Chuck Schumer, people like Senator Pat Murray, Democrats like Dick Durbin. I mean, all of these Democrats, they were in office when former President Clinton was accused of rape by Juanita Broderick during his impeachment proceedings over the Monica Lewinsky affair. And not one of them called for an investigation at that time. So, I mean, you want to talk about hypocrisy and not taking these things seriously? I absolutely think that this should be taken seriously. My problem is not that this woman necessarily waited 35 years before making her accusation. You know, I can understand wanting to be reticent about revealing something like that happened to you. I get that. I understand that. I understand why people who were abused might want to wait. My problem is not that delay. My problem is the later delay. When she wrote her letter, she chose to write her letter to congressional Democrats, right? She didn't go to law enforcement. She didn't go to the media. She went to a partisan source to tell her story. And what did that partisan source do with the story? They sat on it. That is the delay that's a problem. That is a delay that undermines the credibility of this whole thing. That is a problem. That muddies the waters. Now, I understand that in some cases for Senator Heidi Heitkamp, that muddying of the waters is politically advantageous for her, because she's not responsible for muddying the waters. Other Democrats are. But she can hide in the muck that it creates around this situation. And I think that was the intent. That was the purpose. Democrats were willing to sacrifice some of the credibility of this claim against Kavanaugh for the sake of political expediency. And they did it. That's what they did. There's no denying it. It's right out there in front of us. And it's unfortunate. I wish they hadn't done that. It makes this whole thing, which is already difficult, by the way, it's already hard to adjudicate something like this 30 years after the fact, 35 years after the fact, 36, whatever the number is. I think it's like 35, 36 years after the fact. The problem is we don't even really know that timeline because the accuser, this Professor Ford, doesn't recall when exactly it happened or where exactly it happened. And she's contradicted herself on the past on how many people are in the room. These are real problems about her accusation. If she doesn't remember how many people in the room, how does she remember that it was Brett Kavanaugh that was on top of her? If it even happened in the first place. We don't know. These are problems. And this is what really stinks about this whole thing is a lot of how people view this situation is going to be shaped on whether they're a Republican or a Democrat. So partisans like Dan are going to come out and they're going to carry on as if, right, because Dan's already saying, well, he's just like the priests who abused kids 40 years ago. Okay, so we're just assuming at this point that Kavanaugh did it? He doesn't get the benefit of a doubt. He gets accused and that's it? If that's the world we're going to live in now, all somebody has to do is make an accusation and then that's it? You can ruin somebody's life? And by the way, he didn't just raise to prominence now. I mean, this guy has been in office in 2012, right? When this woman, or when this Professor Ford was telling her therapist about this, she was referring to somebody who was in high power in Washington, D.C. Right? Kavanaugh's been in the public light for years. He's undergone a half dozen FBI background checks. He was in the public light during the Clinton administration when he was a lawyer for Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr. He was in the limelight when he was appointed by this Senate to sit on the U.S. District Court of Appeals. Which, by the way, if he doesn't get confirmed to the United States Supreme Court, he continues to be a United States District Court judge in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Unless he, for some reason, should resign from that position, which is based on what we know now, he shouldn't. But this is the problem. I don't... We are so far beyond decency, right? I mean, we're in a situation where people can't set aside their partisanship to consider something like this, right? I mean, Democrats couldn't even set aside their partisanship long enough to report this to authorities immediately upon having learned about it, right? Once this alleged victim writes her letter to Democrats, she is making a choice to join into the debate over Kavanaugh. Democrats should have acted on that immediately. They didn't. That's on them. They can't unring that bell. That's their problem. Now, going forward, I don't think Republicans should slam through Kavanaugh. I do think there needs to be some delay. We need to slow this process down. We need to allow some time to consider this. We need to allow some time for additional information to come out. Because I'll tell you what, if he's the sort of person who tried to rape a woman when he was 17 years old, if that's really who he is, then I guarantee you there are other problems out there. And if we give it some time, it'll come out. But if we give it some time and nothing comes out, we have no additional evidence, and we give it some time and the accuser is allowed to speak under oath before the Senate and no additional information comes out, if we don't learn anything new at that point, and if Judge Kavanaugh is allowed to speak under oath before the Senate Judiciary Committee and continues to deny this and we don't learn any more information, then I think we've got to confirm him, and it needs to happen before Election Day, because Democrats should not get away with throwing a bomb. Because imagine what if this is the precedent now, right? Because what happens is when one side uses a dirty pool tactic, then the other side uses it. So Democrats, is this what you want or under some future president, Democratic president, and he's making appointments to the court that Republicans don't like, and now it's just going to be a lot of completely unfounded accusations? We're just going to try to derail everybody by throwing every accusation that somebody from their past might want to make, whether it's substantiated or not? Is that's the future you want? Because if you take a partisan approach to this, that's the future we're going to get. Because the one thing we have learned about Republicans and Democrats is they will continue to one-up one another when it comes to getting down into the mud. One side, I mean, that's what happened to the filibuster, right? We used to have a filibuster in place. I mean, we wouldn't even be at this point probably with Kavanaugh because there would be a filibuster in place. Democrats could use a filibuster to block his nomination. But we don't have the filibuster because if we wind back to the Senate Democratic majority under Harry Reid, Democrats changed the rules. They said, we're not going to do filibusters anymore for judicial appointments who aren't to the Supreme Court. And then Republicans got, and they re-upped the Democrats, and they said, we're not going to do filibusters anymore for United States Supreme Court appointments. And that's where we are today. The two parties one-upping one another. At some point, we've got to set aside partisanship and do what's right. But I don't know if we're going to be able to do that. More to come straight ahead. This is the Rob Report, 970 WDAY AM 93.1 FM. Let's talk about something a little bit more fun. What would you think about Amtrak passenger service from Chicago to Fargo, running through places like St. Cloud, running through places like the Twin Cities? There's a nonprofit group called All Aboard Minnesota. They want to do it. We're going to talk with Brian Nelson from that organization coming up next here on the Rob Report, 970 WDYM, 93.1 FM. Don't go away. Welcome back, Rob Report, 970 WDYM, 93.1 FM. What would you think about expanding Amtrak service in our region? That's what a group out of Minnesota wants to do. They're calling themselves All Aboard Minnesota, and what they're proposing would be essentially a daytime passenger train service from Fargo to Chicago, which with stops in between. Between Fargo and Chicago is a whole lot of Minnesota. So obviously stops in between would benefit Minnesota as well. What do you think? What do you think of this idea? Here to talk with me about it is Brian Nelson, who is a spokesman for the group. Brian, how are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Now, my understanding, I think a lot of people hear Amtrak, and particularly in our part of the world, don't view it as a very successful enterprise. And I think the reason for that, Amtrak has a lot of success. The bulk of its success is typically in the northeastern part of the country. And to me, that makes a lot of sense. It's densely populated, you know, a lot of people close together, not very spread out, a lot of commuters. It's an obvious that the rail service very successful there. I would argue that out here, not as successful. I don't know that a lot of I know the Empire Line in particular loses a lot of money, mostly, I think, because we don't have very dense populations out here. We have a lot of very wide out spaces. It just doesn't work as well out here. Am I describing that accurately? I mean, I guess I should say that's my impression of things. Is that accurate?
So you raise a number of very interesting issues. So first off, the Empire Builder in its route from Chicago through Montana, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, that train carries about 455,000 passengers a year. And so the words not successful, I don't think apply because that train hauls over 140,000 Minnesotans a year. The schedule through Fargo, agreed, is not optimal. It goes eastbound and westbound in the middle of the night. But that particular train hauls a lot of people in what we call city pairs, you know, people going from Minneapolis to Fargo or Fargo to Whitefish to go skiing or, you know, rural people in Montana going from Glasgow down to Minneapolis to seek medical treatment, Minot to Minneapolis, you know, going to the Air Force Base or to Williston to work in the oil field. So that train does have a tremendous amount of utility in terms of the cities that it serves. It serves a lot of very rural areas.
Well, there's a lot of people that ride on it, but I guess my argument, I think what people would argue is that it doesn't revenue flow. Like there aren't enough, the revenue from the tickets purchased aren't necessarily covering the cost of the operation. Is that fair to say?
Actually, it's not. Because from a allocated cost basis, the Empire Builder covers its operating costs. When people talk about the Northeast Corridor making an operating profit, that's true in the sense that it does create an operating profit. But when you factor in all the infrastructure costs to maintain the Northeast Corridor, tunnels, bridges, everything that's required to keep it running, the Northeast Corridor actually loses more money than the long-distance train train network does. And that's a very common perception, even one that Amtrak wants to make, that the Northeast Corridor is profitable and the long-distance trains are not, and that is not true. I will go on record to say that is a false and misleading statement.
See, that's why I wanted to talk about some of this. I like the idea of what you're proposing for all aboard Minnesota. And the reason why I like it is because here, I mean, we're obviously would be the terminus of your proposal. I like it mostly because one thing that we struggle with here in North Dakota is worker shortages. We have a chronic labor shortage. And so I think anything that makes it easier to come to North Dakota, to visit North Dakota, to work in North Dakota, generally I'm for. Now, what I don't want to do is have some taxpayer subsidized boondoggle where we're paying a lot of money to have, you know, subsidize half empty trains. And I think a lot of times that's the perception of Amtrak, which is that it's, I'll tell you, a lot of people view it as a boondoggle, rightly, fairly or unfairly. So I have a feeling that when you propose this, you're going to probably meet a lot of resistance from those sorts of people who are perceiving it that way.
Well, actually, you know, Amtrak is probably one of the most efficient rail carriers in the world from a fare box recovery perspective. It covers 94 cents on the dollar. And remember that every form of transportation within the U.S., buses, you know, subsidized by federal highways, airlines, Delta Airlines, they're all subsidized by the federal government. Airlines don't pay property taxes. Airlines don't pay for the FAA. Airlines don't pay for airports. And, yes, user taxes recover some of that money, but remember that every form of transportation in this country is subsidized by the federal government.
Okay. So tell us, give us the why would this work? Why would this be good for Minnesota? Why would it, frankly, be good for North Dakota?
Well, it's good for several reasons. One is that it would provide a daytime schedule from Fargo to the Twin Cities and into Chicago, opposite the schedule of the Empire Builder. So it's connecting, you know, outstate Minnesota to Fargo, Fargo to the Twin Cities on an optimal daytime schedule. It would be competitive with drive times. It helps to get people out of their cars on a congested freeway. It provides more mobility options for people who cannot or do not like to drive or fly. And millennials especially, I think, as we're coming to see, don't even like to have cars and like the option of rail travel. And rail travel really offers, you know, tremendous comfort, flexibility. You can bring more luggage on a train. You have the freedom to move around. You know, the time is really your own. You know, in terms of if you want to work or read or sleep or chat or get some food, or it's just a really relaxing, enjoyable mode of travel. And, you know, surveys have really spelled that out, that people really enjoy taking trains when they can. There's been a whole expansion of corridor-type services like this in the Midwest, you know, Chicago to St. Louis, Chicago to Detroit, and those trains have filled up, you know, within the space of a year. So, you know, I think rail travel offers a really unique mobility option that just can't be realized by adding more airlines and highway frequencies.
So, I mean, who would you envision using this? I mean, are you talking about people commuting back and forth to, you know, say the Twin? I mean, who is this for?
So this is really providing, again, another mobility option for people who don't want to drive or don't want to fly or can't. There's, you know, the elderly population, you know, it's difficult to get on and off of airplanes and things like that. They can't drive. So it really serves a whole number of targeted audiences in terms of, you know, millennials, baby boomers, families with kids. It's easy for parents to get on with kids and with baby strollers and carriages and things like that. So it really serves a whole variety of constituencies.
Yeah, 701-293-9000, 888-970-9329, email talk@wday.com. I'll tell you, I don't like to fly. I used to like to fly. I don't like to fly so much in the post-9/11 era. Because it's a hassle, man. It's expensive, and it's an enormous hassle. And I think, you know, driving a lot of times though isn't an option either. I feel like if trains were more of an option, I might use them. So what needs to happen? I mean, people are hearing this, and I mean, what's the timeline on this? I mean, what needs to happen in order for this to become a thing?
Great question. So what needs to happen is citizens need to put pressure on their Minnesota legislatures to fund these services. These are services typically paid for by the states. And, you know, Minnesota has really predominantly focused on highways and roads, bridges, things like that. And what we're proposing is to take a little piece out of that pie and focus on adding additional frequencies on tracks that already serve Amtrak trains, as we know. So it's using existing infrastructure. It can be gotten up and running at a fraction of the cost of building new highways or airports. And if the legislature does fund it, we could see additional service by 2021, 2022.
All right. How much money? I mean, how much? I think that's a fair question. What would this cost?
Yep. So the studies vary in terms of capital costs and operating costs. But from an operating cost perspective, you know, you're really looking at like $1.5 million a year. And when you consider all the money that Minnesota spends on roads and bridges, that's just a tiny drop in the bucket.
And $1.5 million a year to serve. Did you have an estimate of how many people would use a service like this?
Very good question. Yes, you read my mind. So what the MnDOT State Rail Planning Office is estimating is that this would generate anywhere from between 150,000 to 200,000 additional new riders per year. This would not cannibalize the existing Amtrak ridership on the Empire Builder, but this would generate and tap into new markets, new riders that would use the service in a daytime frequency.
Now, you mentioned obviously Empire Builder is providing, you know, servicing some of the demand for this. Are we going to just take passengers away from Empire Builder by doing this?
No. The MnDOT has done extensive studies, and the 150,000 to 200,000 riders a year would be new. They would be incremental. They would be not cannibalizing the riders that use the Empire Builder. So we're tapping into new markets. We're reaching new constituencies, as I mentioned before. And, you know, it's really tapping into a need for people that would want to use a train on a daytime schedule from Fargo to the Twin Cities and beyond.
Is there any concern about putting more traffic on our rails? I remember back during the oil boom, and this wasn't necessarily, this was a problem that arose from, you know, the fact that we didn't have enough pipeline capacity. So all of a sudden we started producing a ton of oil. We didn't have all the pipeline capacity. We needed to take it out of state. So a lot of that was going on the rails. This created a backlog. It impacted ag. I mean, so we had, you know, the oil industry competing with the ag industry, competing with passenger rail service, and we had a real backlog on our rails. Is there anybody like the ag industry or the oil industry is looking at this? Do they need to be concerned about this, you know, more rails, more passenger rail service, you know, being an obstacle to getting their goods to market?
We haven't heard anything specifically, but BN has invested tremendous millions and millions of dollars in what's called double tracking, the line from Minnesota through Fargo, beyond into Montana. And so there's been tremendous investment by the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway in their infrastructure to move goods and services and passengers a lot more efficiently. And we have seen the on-time performance of the Empire Builder improve as a result. And typically when corridor trains, you know, run in a slot like this, they are very dependable because the railroad is able to schedule those, and the on-time dependability is usually in the very high 90s.
Well, that's good. And I know what double tracking is because I used to play Railroad Tycoon once upon a time. That was a lot of fun. I don't know. I like the idea. I think I need to learn more about it, but I think it's honestly, I think the more options we give, and speaking as a North Dakotan here, the more options we have for people to visit here, come here, work here, travel. I mean, that's all to the good. So I like the idea. Is there any need? I mean, obviously the terminus here is in Fargo, but Fargo's not very far into North Dakota. Is there any need at all to ask North Dakota? I mean, is there a need for where the North Dakota's legislature may need to consider funding for this or anything along those lines?
Absolutely. So, you know, this this is a multi-state effort, you know, primarily between Minnesota and Wisconsin right now. You know, ideally, you know, there would be more service to Grand Forks, you know, things of that nature. So, yes, if North Dakota is willing to weigh in and help that, that just greatly helps the whole situation.
Yeah. Well, it could. I mean, we have, again, an eternal problem here where we just don't have enough people for all the jobs, Brian. So if you know some people in your part of the world who need some jobs, you send them our way because we can use them.
Will do. Will do. Absolutely.
All right. Brian, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
That's Brian Nelson with All Aboard Minnesota. I don't know. I like the idea. I need to learn more, but I like where their head's at. Let's put it that way. Hey, we're going to come right back. We'll wrap the show up after this. This is the Rob Report, 970 WDAY AM 93.1 FM. Don't go away. Welcome back. Wrapping up the Rob Report here. If you want to get in, you still can. 701-293-9000, 888-970-9329. Email talk at WDAY.com. Do you like riding the plane or a train, Eric? Is that a thing?
Never done it. Always wanted to try. I had some friends who recently took their family out skiing in Montana. And they took the Amtrak out there, and they enjoyed it. And actually, my dad was talking to me over the weekend when he was going to school at NDSU. He used to take the train Friday afternoon up to Jamestown, and because that's where he grew up. So he would ride the train Friday afternoon. I think he said it left about 3:30, 4 o'clock, and would ride up to Jamestown and then come back on Sunday.
Oh.
So that was probably back in the very early 70s that happened.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea. I mean, I think the problem with trains in our neck of the world, they get delayed a lot, right? I hear people tell me that all the time, especially in the winter when you get bad weather,
sure,
bad snows. I mean, obviously any sort of travel that time of year can get delayed by our weather. It just seems like trains can be particularly vulnerable to that, I want to say. So I don't know. I have misgivings too about the cost of running passenger service. On the other hand, I mean, I like that options. I do think the attitudes are shifting in transportation. I think what he said about millennials not necessarily liking to own cars. I don't know how true that is in our part of the world where owning a car is sort of a necessity, but I do know that attitudes about it are shifting. I do know that North Dakota needs to be flexible in how we get people here. It's not necessarily a bad idea. So I think that's very, very interesting. Talking about the Kavanaugh thing, I have a feeling this is going to be a very ugly week, Eric.
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree with that.
For both sides. I definitely want to, you know, at least have a degree of certainty about this. I want to provide some room so that if there's more information to come out, we could get there. I feel like Democrats have done a solid disservice by the way they handled this. I think these things are hard enough to begin with without adding a veneer of seeming partisanship to it. Not even seeming. Adding a veneer of partisanship. That's what they did. And that was terrible. That makes this whole thing harder. But if Judge Kavanaugh did that, he should not be on the Supreme Court. The problem is I don't know that he did. Or even if they were together in that room, how do we even know that her characterization is correct? We don't know. I mean, we're in a he said, she said situation, and the rest of us are left 35 plus years after the fact asking ourselves, who's telling the truth? Who should we believe? None of us really know either of these people on a personal level. And even if you did, people you know and you think are great people could do awful things. So who knows? You know, that's the problem with this sort of thing is, do we derail this man's life, right? I do think the Republicans would be smart. I don't think the decision's been made yet, but I would bet that the Senate Judiciary Committee is not going to be holding a vote on Judge Kavanaugh this week. And that's for the best. If Republicans jam him down our throats, this is going to be hanging over his head. It's going to be hanging over his head for the rest of his life anyway. It'd be even worse if they did that. So I'm glad they're not. I hope they don't do that. I hope we give this some time. Hey, Jay Thomas Show straight ahead. This is the Rob Report, 970 WDAY AM, 93.1 FM. Thanks for listening. I'm here Monday through Friday, 12 to 2 p.m., 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at sayanythingblog.com. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again.